This recording has been released into the public domain by the Bonson Institute, where we aim to bring into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ.
All right, the second element of the outline on Marx is an overview now of Marxism itself, rather than just the man per se. And I have written down here a series of comparisons between Marx and other 19th century philosophers, which I think if you will study and reflect on and not just write it down mechanically in your notes, will help you to have an appreciation for how it fits into this total mix of the 19th century. Like Bentham and Comte, C-O-M-T-E, like Bentham and Comte, Marx wanted to apply science to social problems. So this is, as you can see, a 19th century characteristic. Bentham had his notion of what science is. Comte had his positivistic view of science. Marx likewise wants to apply science to social problems. Like Kierkegaard, Marx thought the key issue is not just speculation, but doing. We've got to change the world, not just reflect on the world. So in that sense, he's somewhat like Kierkegaard in the dedication to action, to doing, to making a commitment rather than just reflecting at a distance. Like Nietzsche, Marx saw theories as hiding self-serving motives. Remember Nietzsche said all philosophers are just like lawyers. Everything a person says is the outworking of a preconception that he has. And Marx, like Nietzsche, looked upon theorizing as always hiding self-serving motives or expressing things which are not really on the surface of what's being said. Like the Romantics, Kierkegaard, and Nietzsche, Marx held that man feels a deep alienation within himself. This notion of alienation is really pervasive in the 19th century. The Romantics feel alienated from nature. Kierkegaard, man is alienated internally, has no center. Nietzsche, the same idea of the alienated man who needs to get beyond predetermined values and be an overman for himself. Marx, too, sees man as feeling alienation. Like Feuerbach, Marx saw religion as a dream, a projection of man. Men have religions, but they are projections of their own inner needs, reflecting other things that have nothing to do with a transcendent being. Like Feuerbach and Haeckel, Marx felt that only the time-space realm exists. He was a materialist, like Feuerbach and Haeckel. Like Darwin, Marx felt that everything is developmental, needing a historical genetic perspective to be understood. Everything evolves. Everything is developmental. And like Hegel, he believed this historical development is dialectical in nature, and progressing toward a climax, is dialectical in nature and progressing toward a climax. Now, I hope you can understand those those comparisons. It isn't really, it's the sort of thing you might predict to show up on an exam somewhere. You might have a question that says, put Marx in his historical context. So you want to be able to explain all these other thinkers and how Marx agrees with them on this. Karl Marx was a crude, dirty, repulsive, ill-tempered, exploitive, ambitious, deceitful, bitter, self-centered, irresponsible with money, failure of a man, who could nevertheless write with apparent erudition. I'm going to let you read Paul Johnson give you some idea of the character of this man. But in my own estimation, from what I've read of his life in Johnson and elsewhere, and what others said about him who were supporters and friends even. Let me give it to you again. Marx was in fact a crude, dirty, repulsive, ill-tempered, exploitive, ambitious, deceitful, bitter, self-centered, irresponsible, monetarily irresponsible failure of a man. And yet he could write with erudition. As he aged, apparently he became even more and more blatant and severe with people. He was very obviously a proud, scornful, vengeful, and threatening man. Marx would look at his opponents and scowl and say, "I will annihilate you." What an animal. And on top of it, he was obviously with his opponents and with his own family, including his wife, rude and disloyal. Well, I'm not going to hide the fact. I guess you know by now, don't you? Like, give us a hint, Dr. Bronson. What do you think of the man? I don't like Karl Marx. I don't respect Karl Marx, but that isn't really what's important. In the end, we have to look at his philosophy and understand it. But you need to know that this man who has had such a grievous influence on the late 19th and especially 20th centuries was a man who was something of a moral monster. When you look at his system of thought, it is characterized by elaborate jargon, epigrams and cliches, and pushy rhetoric. Now, from what I've said about Hegel and others, I guess you know, this also does not endear me to Karl Marx. And that, you might say that either reflects my temperament or my training or both, because my philosophical training has been in linguistic analysis primarily. And so I value clarity and precision, logical order, that sort of thing. And Marx is anything but clear, precise, and orderly in his presentation of things. He gets bogged down in jargon, probably fools and deceives himself by his own jargon. And there's a great deal. The reason why he seemed erudite is because he had a way of capturing expressions, you know, in epigrammic, cliched form. But as you know, epigrams and cliches lead you into a lot of trouble because they're imprecise and easily misunderstood. And his rhetoric was especially pushy in the sense that rather than refute his opponents, he sneered at his opponents. He was self-righteous. It was like he took the moral high ground against his opponents, and his rhetoric was, "How dare you?" Often he would dismiss criticism as being the result of bourgeois interest. So he looks at the motivation and the origin of the criticism rather than answering it on its merits or lack thereof. Interpretations of Marx, even whole systems of Marxian interpretation, have sprung up and taken a life of their own in the name of Marx. And many times these systems, alleged systems of Marxian interpretation, have taken on their own life without primary source citations or without adequate primary source citations, which are sensitive to the context in which Marx wrote. Indeed, some popular versions of Marx actually stand explicitly in contrast to what Marx said. Isn't that amazing? Now, I have to warn you of that because my guess is not one of you here today understands Marx. You have bits and pieces, and you've heard popular cliches. Maybe you've even heard quotations from Marx, abolition of private property, that sort of thing. But when we work out his system in detail, I think you'll be surprised at what he presented as his view of history, economics, and political reform. What goes under the name of Marx today, you need to realize, not only are there conflicting interpretations, but most of those interpretations are not geared to, well, I can talk to you as Christians here, scripture and verse. What would you think if somebody came in and gave you a lecture? In fact, if you were to go to a secular university, you would have people do this, give you a lecture on what Christianity is, and they go on and on talking about what theologians have said, you know. Let's say that they talk about Thomas Aquinas, or then they talk about Friedrich Schleiermacher, and they talk about Emil Brunner, or maybe they talk about the liberation theologians of our day. And this is what their view of Christianity is. Now, wouldn't you say, but professor, the problem is you should have gone back to the Bible. You should have gone back to the original, you know, literary source for Christianity to present what Christianity is. And this is, even though I despise him as a man and as a scholar, this is what has been so lacking in Marx's scholarship. Scripture in verse is just not available, or things are said in the name of Marx which are actually contrary to what Marx himself said. And so I'm trying to set you up for my formal lecture and development of Marx, because I think you're going to be surprised that what passes for Marxism is not what Marx had to say in many cases and in very important aspects of the system that's given. Marxism is not simply the rhetoric of socialism, simple, or if you will, previous socialism. Socialism has been around for a long time. Revolutionary socialism has been around for a long time. Marx was not simply picking up socialist rhetoric and advancing it in the new name of communism. This is not simply socialism backed up now with a call to revolution and justifying compulsion. That would be oversimple to the point of distorting communism. Communism is not just socialism with a call to revolution. Perhaps the best summary of Marxism that you can find is in Engels' book, Socialism, Utopian and Scientific. That socialism colon, utopian and scientific. The point being that communism is a version of socialism that is not utopian, but rather scientific. And indeed, now this is going to be interesting, not only is Engels' book on socialism perhaps the best summary of Marx, much of what Marx presented originated with Engels. For instance, Marx openly admitted that his crisis theory in economics came from Engels. It was Marx who first sought out Engels because he had been impressed with the disproportionality thesis that was advanced by Engels. In a few minutes when I explain disproportionality, you'll understand that. But the point is, that came from Engels. That was not Marx's idea. It was later the driving thought behind Das Kapital. Engels and Marx collaborated extensively over 40 years and co-authored many publications, including, most importantly, the Communist Manifesto. Indeed, some things written entirely by Engels were published under the name of Marx. And at this point, it is probably impossible to disentangle their writings and ideas. Whatever you're reading under the name of Marx, it'd be very difficult for you to know whether that's Engels' thinking, maybe Engels' writing, or Marx himself, because they collaborated, wrote extensively, talked to one another. I mean, all of this is like a fruit salad. It's all mixed together. So I'm going to call it Marxism, but I also want to make it clear for historical accuracy, it's really Marx-Engels-ism. You really can't, in all justice, simply call it the thought of Karl Marx. For years, Engels supported Marx and Marx's daughters, by the way, financially. And to show you how close their relationship was, this is really perverse, but to save Marx's marriage, Engels falsely took responsibility for a child that was fostered by Marx with his maid. To save the marriage, Engels was willing to say he was the father of the child that was born to the maid. Later it was revealed it was Marx who had fathered the child. So, I mean, Marx and Engels, I mean, they're close. Ideologically, financially, even in terms of family responsibilities. I'm going to call it Marxism. Please remember at every point, however, I'm referring to Engels and Marx, and I don't know how to disentangle them. Another point by way of introduction to the system. Marxist communism must not be identified with the views of later political parties and national governments that are labeled communist. Marx's communism must be distinguished from the views of later political parties and later national governments that have been called communist. My guess is most of you think of communism as what the Soviet Union in the 20th century experienced after the 1917 revolution. And yet Lenin explicitly corrected Marx and made alterations. Lenin corrected Lenin, I mean, in terms of a zigzag of policies, social and economic and so forth. And so this is the lowest level. We can get much more detailed later if you want. You must distinguish Leninism from Marxism. They are not the same. And there are various versions of Marx, as I've already told you. But most of what we've seen in the 20th century under the name of communism as a party or a national government is in various ways untrue to, if not contradictory, to the writings of Marx. And then one final introductory remark about the system. You need to realize that Marx dealt with contrary facts, inconvenient facts, as well as alternative interpretations of history, and the exposure of conceptual contradictions in his system. Not with intellectual refutation, but with personal disdain and self-righteous rhetoric. Now, I'm going for the jugular here. I'll be real honest with you. Now, I've already told you I utterly detest this man and his system of thought. I detest what it's done to the world. But from a scholarly standpoint, you need to realize that when Marx had either facts that were contrary to him presented, or when he had conceptual contradictions presented to him in his system and so forth, he personally disdained his opponents and self-righteously dismissed them with rhetoric. Marx did not, in any responsible scholarly way, deal with possible counterindications and refutations. Who does this remind you of? Somebody else I didn't have a high opinion of. Remember Herr Professor Hegel? Student says, "Professor, the facts are against your theory." He says, "Well, then the facts be hung." This is a great danger. It's not just a 19th century thought, but a great danger that's seen in Hegelianism and Marxism both. In the end, in the name of respecting precision and greater determinativeness, dealing with the facts are ignored for the sake of the system. Marxism is an anti-intellectual ideology. As an example, I've mentioned this already, the genetic fallacy is used when criticisms are dismissed as arising from bourgeois motivation. You know, so like if someone from the middle class were to criticize Marxism, he would dismiss it as, well, obviously your middle class position leads you to say those things. Well, in logic, you learn that whatever the position of the person is socially or historically is irrelevant. What about what he had to say? Okay, so maybe you disdain the person. Can you imagine somebody today responding, you know, or dismissing outright what certain Negroes have had to say about their plight in America by saying, well, yeah, but that's what a black person would say. Well, in our day and age, we've become so sensitive to racism, that's so politically incorrect, that you can see the error immediately. You can't dismiss what is said because of the person who said it or their circumstances. That's racist logic. Well, the same sort of thing, I'm telling you, is what Marx demonstrated throughout his life. It wasn't racism so much, but it was like bourgeois interests don't have to be taken into account. It's an anti-intellectual ideology. You might have enjoyed, in a certain perverse way, the response of the Philosophers Association in Moscow when I was there a couple of years ago and gave a lecture on Karl Marx, in which my argument was basically Marx presented an alternative religion to Christianity and that his religion was in fact utopian. By the way, that's a great insult to say of a communist that you're utopian rather than scientific. And so that was the That was the thrust of my lecture. And the spirit of Karl Marx lives on. There were a couple of the people in the room that I think quite literally were prepared to pull out weapons and attack me. They were furious. You can't even consider the possibility, you see, that there was something wrong with Karl Marx. You know, and to suggest these sorts of things is met with disdain rather than refutation. Okay, we've introduced the man, overview, introduced the system. Now I would like to work through what communism actually is, as Marx and Engels presented it. I'll be quoting at the end, but I want to tell you as well that my lectures are being based primarily now on a work which is just, I mean, I can hardly praise it enough, Thomas Sowell's book, Marxism, Philosophy, and Economics. I highly recommend you all get this and read it for greater detail. You can get summaries of Marx all sorts of places. As you know, W.T. Jones, the books that I have been using, has one. But I think Sowell's analysis is so brilliant and also tied to primary source quotations that he'll be the one that I'm using. So where do we begin? The philosophy of Marx and Engels. According to Marx, the world is not made up of isolated observable facts, but rather a set of processes which unfold according to their inner tensions. When you theoretically analyze the world, you'll see not isolated facts, but these various processes of unfolding of inner tension, what he called contradictions, and which result in a qualitative transformation. Now, all I'm telling you here, I know we're back to the jargon of Hegel, but you already know about this. This is just Hegelianism, developmental reading of history. And what forces the developments ahead are inner contradictions or inner tensions. And when they are resolved, it's not just a quantitative resolution, like a little bit for you, a little bit for me, but it's a qualitative transformation so that the issues change. They're at a higher level, if you will. Think here of the metamorphosis of a caterpillar. If you were to do an analysis of a caterpillar and do it historically, you'd have to say there are inner biological tensions, right, that are working its way out. And when those tensions work their way out, does the caterpillar just look like a bigger caterpillar? No, it's qualitatively changed into a butterfly, right? That's what history is like, metamorphosis. From one thing which that's accurate, that's an approximation as far as it goes to call it a caterpillar, but it's really on its way to being a butterfly. And so a discussion of change from within is what Marx offers to explain not the outward or empirical appearance of things, but their inner essence. The discussion of dialectical historical change from within, is a discussion of the essence of things, not their appearance. It's a discussion of their history and their potential for change. Therefore, what Marx discusses in terms of history is not outward empirical appearance, but rather the unseen and rationally analyzable tensions in a society that generate a revolution from within. Now, this is the first major point that I want to make sure you all catch. Marx did not believe in fomenting a coup against the government. That would be an external change, right? People from outside the government raising arms in a military way, forcing externally a change in the government. Marx believed that society generates the revolution from within. It's a natural development, not an external, you know, forced development. So what we said thus far is that he's following Hegel. Marx believed that thwarted human development, thwarted social development, where human needs are subordinated to artificially created things, brings man's alienation. Human needs can be subordinated to religion, and that creates alienation psychologically. Human needs can be subordinated to capitalism, and that brings social alienation. So when human needs are thwarted, either individually human or corporately human, social development, then we have the condition of alienation. Marx's view of science was not that it simply gathers facts aimlessly, but rather science must aim to systematize the facts, to explain not just the outward empirical appearance of things, but the inner essence of things. The complexity of particulars that we experience in the world leads us to abstract the essential features or the underlying forces from the accidental factors that we see in history. To put it very simply, Marx was not a simplistic empiricist who said, just go out there, look at the appearances, gather them together, collect them. That's the truth. He said, science must systematize what we see, and that forces us to go behind it to find the underlying factors of its development. Science analyzes relationships for their general tendency. And therefore, Marx was willing to distinguish between the necessary and the chance elements of history and the world. Certain aspects of history are determined. They're necessary. Those are the underlying patterns, the unseen forces that are at work. But there are also incidental or chance elements as well. Marx was, as you know, a materialist. He wrote his doctoral dissertation on Democritus and Epicurus. But he was not a mechanistic determinist, like the Baron de Holbach or Ernst Haeckel. He was not a mechanistic determinist where the causality is one way. You know, you have external forces working on something. One billiard ball hits another billiard ball, which goes across the table, hits another billiard ball. He didn't believe in historical causation being one way. Now, you know that already from what I told you, because he's what? Dialectical. He believes the hidden underlying forces that drive history influence one another. Causality is dialectical. Men are not simply products of their environment, not simply products of their circumstances, because according to Marx, men change their circumstances. So there's a back and forth. There's a dialectic. Is this man, is it by his choice, or is this something necessary from the circumstances? Well, they interact. They go back and forth. Marx was influenced by Feuerbach, I've already told you. Feuerbach said that religion is the projection of man's alienated essence, or if you will, his unfulfilled longings and ideals. Men are made of matter, but they have unfulfilled longings. They have ideals for humanity. And what they do is they project that into a religion. Marx agreed with that. He called religion the opium of the masses. But what you need to understand is that by calling it the opium of the masses, he wasn't, well, this is a matter of degree, I realize. But relatively speaking, this was not a cut low. It was not kind of a real hammering against religion, being nasty about it. Marx was trying to offer what he thought was a scholarly analysis that religion is really the realization of human essence in fantasy form. Religion is the attempt to realize our human essence, but by means of illusion rather than in the actual experience that we have. And so when human needs are not fulfilled in actual experience, what happened is that people project their human needs, their ideals, and their longings into a religious dream. And that then becomes the opium that enables them to get over the headache. Life is a headache. Religion helps you get over it. The opium of the masses. It's a painkiller regarding the social situation which is alienating you. Okay, so we see the influence of Hegelian thinking, the influence of Nietzschean type of thinking, and then somewhat the influence of a Kierkegaardian outlook, and I'm going to give you a quotation I want you to have in your notes. Marx said, "The philosophers have only interpreted the world in various ways," underline interpreted. "The point, however, is to change it." The point, however, is to change it. So in the end, he didn't want vain philosophical speculation. He wanted the practice of philosophy, the practice of the truth that changes the world. And of course, that's how Marx skirted any theory, any thorny philosophical problems with his own theories. If someone were to bring up an intellectual problem with his system, he'd say, look, the point here is not to speculate. The point here is to get out and change the world. Let's take a possible criticism of Marx from what we've presented already. Someone might say, if everything is matter, then isn't it an illusion to think there's a reality to ideas and to our thinking? If everything is matter, then how can you have any kind of systematic presentation of the essence of things? How can there be any thinking or theorizing at all if everything is matter? Marx replied to that, and I quote, "The reality or non-reality of thinking, which is isolated from practice, is a purely scholastic question." And in the same context, he said, "The proof of the pudding is in the eating." Okay? And so, a kind of Kierkegaardian commitment to, I don't care what seems absurd, what's important is commitment to doing, to changing the world. Well, then, what did Marx think accounted for the transformation of societies? Before I answer that question, let me just repeat for you what we have seen about Marx. Marx, I'm trying here primarily to cleanse from your thinking the misrepresentations of Marx that stand out there in the popular mentality, popular presentations. Marx did not believe in fomenting a coup against the government. He believed that revolutions are a natural metamorphosis that come from the inner tensions of history. He believed that men feel alienation, and one of the ways in which they sadly try to deal with that is through religious projection. But religion is only an opium, it's only a painkiller that doesn't really take care of the lack of realization of our human potential. He also, in the end, did not want to be a vain speculator. He wanted to be a doer, a changer of history. Okay, so now, how do societies transform? He said the transformations of societies from one age to another are to be explained by their changing technologies. It's the development of technology of various sorts throughout history that changes the society. Because the technologies, according to Marx, change our social relationships. Okay, think about a society where the level of technology is simply your gardening through your family, or even the development of implements or artifacts in your home. Now, that kind of technology is quite different from the technology that sends you out to a faraway, huge farm to use machinery, or to a city to work in a factory, right? There are going to be different social relationships in a factory than in a home business. Again, I'm not going to try to convince you of Marx, but I want you to at least, you know, say and see why he's developing this way. He says, changing technologies change our social relations. And then another step, changing social relations, the way we interact with one another, change our ideologies, the theories that we believe, our outlook and perspective is affected by our social relations. Remember, Marx holds that environment changes and shapes the thinking of people. And so if your environment, your social relations are changed by changing technology, then the changing technologies will give rise ultimately to changing ideologies. And so what we end up with is political conflict. Changing technology has brought political conflict between those who are committed to the status quo, to the existing institutions of society, and those who see a need for drastic change in the society. Right? Imagine that you are one of the owners of a factory and you live in the nicest part of town in a mansion, and you spend your evenings or your weekends going to wonderful social and cultural gatherings, hobnob with the leaders of your society. The people who work for you can barely buy enough bread and potatoes to get by. They have leaking roofs or no place to sleep at all, and so forth. Now, obviously, one group of people thinks the status quo is all right as far as it goes. There's not a great deal of need for change if you're comfortable. Those at the other end of things see a drastic need for change. Different positions in the social organization cause men to assess the specifics of social change in different ways and in irreconcilable ways. You see, let's say a beneficent, wealthy factory owner, let's say he admits there's a need for social change. The specifics that are proposed for change will be seen by him in one way that is completely different than how those specifics are seen by the person that's in the underclass. Now, historically, change is going to come. How do we know that? Because there's an inner dialectic in history, right? Negation pushes out a higher level. The caterpillar is going to become a butterfly. That's going to happen. But how you see that happening, the specifics of change, will be altered by your ideology being determined by your social position. And so you have political conflict. Listen closely. Marx did not believe that this was a deliberate, warring pursuit of self-interest. Marx did not believe that the wealthy capitalist, the factory owner, is just engaged in a war with the underclass to keep them from having what he has. I say that because the rhetoric that we hear today would have you think Marx just thinks everybody's selfish. The underclass wants more, the upper class wants to keep what they have, and that's why they have war. He did not believe that. He did not think that the clash was deliberate. He did not think people were purposely pursuing self-interest. Because if that's all it was, then revolution wouldn't be necessary, would it? If it's just a matter of everyone trying to protect their own interest, then eventually peaceful compromise could come. The upper class could give away a little, and the underclass could get a little, and they could meet halfway or somewhere in the middle, and people could be happier. But on Marx's theory of history, compromise is not possible. A social group which acquires no common ideology or organization is not a class, according to Marx. But where you have social groups that have developed a common outlook and ideology, or if they've developed an organization, a workers' party and so forth, he said the existence of classes is what produces ideological conflict and the subsequent social transformation. All of history is a history of class warfare, conflict. So you have the ideology of the working class, the ideology of the capitalists, the overlords, whatever. They have this different way of looking at the world. And there is a necessary clash, a dialectic between them, okay? Marx did not believe that what he was setting forth could predict, as he said, every sparrow's fall. He said in history there are necessary elements, there are incidental elements. So Marx, unlike Hegel, was not trying to say every detail of what we know could fit the pattern. he was more true to the dialectic here and recognizing there's an underlying essence and an outward appearance of things. And not everything in the outward appearance is going to be predicted by his analysis. But according to Marx, social transformations in history tend to follow the pattern that he was outlining. He wasn't committed to being able to predict what this particular political party would do at this particular year and so forth. Not every sparrow's fall is predicted by the system, but the general pattern is necessary. Okay, so I'm trying to give you some idea of his view of history and qualify it so that the prevailing misconstructions are not in your mind as we go on. He believes that technology brings different ideologies, and that creates class conflict. And that's what's going to bring the revolution, not by people fomenting it from without, but as an inner necessary development. We always see it in history. Now, what's his view of capitalism? According to Marx, capitalism is not defined by private property. After all, there was private property long before capitalism showed up in history. Well, now, that all depends on how you define capitalism, right? I happen to define capitalism as the moral right of private property, and so you can't say that there was private property before capitalism. He's using capitalism in a special sense. Private property is not the essence of capitalism. Capitalism refers to the kind of relationships that are created among people wherein there is a claim on the labor of others. You have capitalism when one person or one group of people have a claim on the labor of others. According to Marx, the new feature that marks the era of capitalism is capital, defined not merely as productive potential. We ordinarily think of capital as productive potential. If you have capital, if you have land, or if you have machinery and factories, so forth, that has a potential for production. But Marx didn't see capital as the potential for production. Capital is the claim on the labor of others. Claim on the labor of others. When production facilities are consolidated into collective means of production, there will be surplus value. Now, you want to put that in quotes. This is a key to understanding Marx. There will be surplus value that is created. We're going to get a lot more efficient in producing brooms, a lot more efficient in making silverware, a lot more efficient in creating dresses and shirts and so forth, when we collectivize the means of production. And when we get more efficient in producing these needs of life, what's going to happen is there will be surplus value. And that surplus value gets appropriated by the private owners who did not work, in the production. All right, so you get the picture? You have capital consolidated, collectively consolidated, and then private individuals skim off the surplus value even though they didn't do the work of producing the brooms or the silverware or the shirts and dresses. Under socialism, ownership of the means of production would also be collective. Not just the means of production being collected, but the ownership would be collective. And that would be then for the benefit of mankind, bringing a higher form of society, because there would be better relationships, different kinds of relationships among people. Is that right? I mean, can't you see some persuasiveness to that? It's true that we have collectivize the means of production to become more efficient, but we haven't collectivized the ownership. And so when we get social or collective ownership of the means of production, then we're going to have a higher form of society. Now, this is very important for you to catch on to. unlike other socialists who railed against capitalist exploitation and those sorts of things, Marx did not see this exploitation that's practiced under capitalism as somehow avoidable, but greedy people will not avoid it. He said the exploitation practiced under capitalism is necessary, has been necessary throughout previous history. In fact, he said the exploitation by the owners of the workers was in fact necessary for progress in previous history. According to him, a privileged few needed to be freed from the urgent needs of staying alive. A privileged few needed to have the leisure to reflect, philosophize, and engage in social work in order to bring ideals, to bring about ideals that could help others to live better. And so far from the picture of Marx that you may have been given, he didn't have any problem with capitalism as one phase of history. In fact, he said it was necessary. If the workers were going to have any kind of amelioration of their circumstances, somebody had to get ahead who could have the freedom to think about human ideals and go out and engage in social reform so the workers could have a better life. Capitalism in the past was a necessary stage of history. What made Marx upset with the capitalism of his day is that he said the recent rapid increase in production that's been made possible by capitalism could now terminate this inequality and make leisure generally available, so that now the masses can enjoy human development as well. This is a very interesting thesis. I think it's wrong historically, but it's certainly not the Marxism that I was, you know, I cut my teeth on. I mean, this is a real improvement in a sense. He says capitalism in the past, the forms of capitalism you had, enabled some people to have more leisure time to enjoy the development of human potential, to get involved in the symphony, you know, or to read literature, to become more humane, to develop human ideals, be interested in their fellow man. Capitalism in the past let a few people have that kind of leisure. But the way in which technology has enabled these huge jumps in the days of Marx, he said, would mean that everybody should be able to enjoy that leisure and not have to worry about just scraping by a living with bread and potatoes. It's the recent rapid increase in production that's been made possible by capitalism, a necessary phase in historical development. It's been made possible by capitalism that should now terminate the inequality between workers and managers and owners and enable leisure to be available to everyone so their human development is made possible. So now all the workers can go home and either learn to play guitar or to read a good book, or to, you know, engage in some kind of cultural pursuit that fulfills their human need, and they won't be as alienated, you see, from their fellow man and from the product of their work as they have been. Naturally, Marx said, naturally, if you look at past patterns of historical development, naturally, however, some people are going to be committed to those past arrangements, and they will resist collectivization of the means of production. It's not as though Marx thinks, all these greedy bastards, these capitalists. He says, it's just natural. The historical development is such that people are going to be tied to the past and their privilege. They're going to want to ameliorate. They're going to be willing to reform. But again, all the details of reform are viewed differently from the bourgeois and the proletariat perspectives. He said, very naturally, then, there's going to be conflict. Some people will want the past arrangements to stay and resist collectivization. Some people will want to see collectivization because capitalism has made possible the equalizing of people so that leisure and human development are possible for everyone. And that creates the revolutionary confrontation of ideologies. And because there's a revolutionary confrontation of ideologies, Where do ideologies come from? What did I tell you? From the class position that you're in, and that leads then to a revolutionary confrontation of classes, social classes. For Marx, economic crises do not arise from excess output or from underconsumption. What's an economic crisis? A depression in the economy, unemployment in the economy. Well, now, there are periods of unemployment, periods of depression throughout history. In fact, Marx held that the periodicity of these crises would be regular under capitalism. He couldn't predict, you know, how long it would be, but he said it's just a regular pattern. There's going to be crisis, and then there's going to be surplus, then crisis, then surplus. He said that is natural to capitalism. But these crises, he said, are not created by an excess of output or a decrease of consumption. This is the crucial turning point in his critique of capitalism. Because any of us could say, of course, there are going to be these cycles. In fact, you can't avoid them. Now, one, let's say somebody starts manufacturing home computers, gets real excited. He goes, "Well, we're going to make a lot of money." And so he makes a lot of home computers. And what you do is you have excess output or underconsumption of those home computers, and the home computer market goes into the pit for a while. Then they adjust and come back and that sort of thing. That kind of cycle, no one has to disagree, takes place. But according to Marx, what causes it is not excess output or underconsumption. It's the disproportionate output of some social sectors. It's that the workers have created the output and the managers and owners have not participated in the work. That disproportion is what causes economic crisis. Next, you need to understand that according to Marx, the value of something should not be identified with its price or its exchange value, if you will. The value of something is its essence. Remember, the essence is what underlies it. The price is only the appearance of value. The price of something is only an imperfect representation of the value of something. He held that under capitalism, profit rates are distorted and then equalized by competition. Under capitalism, the rate of profit is distorted and then tends to be equalized by competition. You should also note that, according to Marx, labor value should not become the basis of prices. This is one of the most common misrepresentations in elementary courses, as though the price of something is its labor value. He did not believe that. Labor value shouldn't be the basis of prices, nor should labor value be the basis for income distribution. Marx was more concerned with what he called surplus value. The surplus value of a product quantifies the exploitation of one person by another. Remember we said the surplus value was skimmed off by the owner, even though he didn't participate in the production. And so if you look at the surplus value of things, you will be quantifying the level of exploitation of one person by another. Marx felt that there was a tendency for the rate of profit to fall. Rates of profit naturally decrease over time. Now, when the rate of profit falls, what is the capitalist owner going to do to compensate? He's going to increase the rate of surplus value. He's going to increase the exploitation of his workers then. Since his profits are diminishing over time, he must now demand more out of his workers so that he can maintain his level of surplus value. And so what happens over time, naturally, is that this promotes resentment. And that resentment between the workers who are being exploited, that resentment that develops, becomes eventually a revolution. Now, you have to understand Marx's view of revolution, and this, I think, is going to be a head-turner for probably all of you. According to Marx, any state that you have is an agency for coercion. Any state, no matter how it came about, democratically or not, is essentially an agent of coercion. And as an agent of coercion, it maintains the dominance of the most powerful or leading class in a society. And so let me give you one of his best-known epigrams. Quote, "The state is nothing but a machine for the oppression of one class by another. The state is nothing but a machine for the oppression of one class by another." So remember, Marx believes that all states are oppressive. All states. That's why in the end, his view is that we need a stateless society. But along the way, he thinks democracy is valuable, and indeed, for a time, necessary. Democracy is a valuable, necessary condition for freedom. Democracy is necessary for political emancipation. That is, you need to have democratic forms for political interaction if men are going to be set free. However, democracy is not adequate for human emancipation. Political emancipation requires democracy. But if you're going to move ahead to human emancipation, you need something beyond that, communism. Because human imagination, he said, requires, and I quote, "quite palpable material conditions." Quite palpable material conditions. You know what he's saying? As long as some people enjoy more than other people, when the means of production would allow equalization, you don't have human emancipation. True emancipation means you need to share in the good things of this world as much as anybody else. Now, capitalists have a way of responding kind of densely, I think, in terms of Marx's analysis. They say, well, now workers are free. What do you mean? They aren't emancipated. They're free. They agree to do the work for the price it is offered. So they're free. Marx would say, yeah, they're free. They agree to work being compelled by social conditions to work. They may not be compelled by raw force. You capitalists are happy to say the army didn't compel these people to come into the factory and work. They agreed to. But Marx says, what forced them to work was social conditions. And capitalism enables you to free them of those social conditions that compel them to work. If you'd share the wealth, which is made possible by the collectivization of the means of production, then they'd all be free to work because they want to work rather than being compelled to work. And so quite palpable material conditions are needed for men to truly be free. And this leads then to an explanation of what he meant by the dictatorship of the proletariat. The Communist Manifesto described, quote, the first step in the revolution as, quote, to raise the proletariat to the position of ruling class to win the battle of democracy. Did you hear that? Marx believed that the revolution would come about democratically. I quote, this is from the Communist Manifesto. The first step in the revolution is to raise the proletariat to the position of ruling class to win the battle of democracy. The dictatorship of the proletariat, referred to by Marx and Engels, was, in Engels' words, the democratic republic. Marx described it in one place as a government of the people by the people. He said that the dictatorship of the proletariat would be characterized by universal suffrage, separation of church and state, and no pretense to the state being infallible. I'm having to load this on you because I'm trying to shake you free of your... That little statement, dictatorship of the proletariat, has been so used in polemical literature that we've gotten away from... Now, Marx probably shouldn't have used that kind of expression. I mean, it's subject to that kind of abuse, I realize. But if you read him in context, his dictatorship of the proletariat meant nothing more than in a democratic society, the workers are the most numerous, so they get their way politically. They win the battle of democracy. And the dictatorship is simply the numerical superiority of the workers, which enables democracy to be in effect, a class dictatorship for them. They can use the democratic machinery to have their way, which ought to show you that what scares me about Marxism is not nearly the call to taking up arms to revolution, but the notion that the underclass can use democratic procedures to get material improvement by voting money into their own pockets, which is what we have in our country today. This may scare you, and I'm not trying to be some kind of conspiracy theorist when I say this at all. In fact, if you understand my lecture, no conspiracy is necessary. It's the natural development of history. What we have today is communism, where people, because they are more numerous, can give quite palpable material improvements to themselves through the democratic process. And that's what Marx was calling for. The dictatorship of the proletariat, the working class, in effect is the dictator of society through the democratic machine. But the proletariat's dictatorship is only a transitional phase, according to Marx. It needs to be an international phase. Please get that in your notes. He believed that this would take place internationally, not just in one locale. But the proletariat's dictatorship is only transitional. We have a dictatorship of the proletariat, the democracy governed by the workers, only as long as the state is necessary. What did I tell you a minute ago? All states represent coercion. And so Marx felt that the dictatorship of the proletariat is only a phase toward the withering away of the state, quote unquote. I want you to be able to explain the withering away of the state. And in his writings, Engels explicitly contrasted the withering of the state to the abolishing of the state. In the same way that you need to see the difference between a coup and a revolution that develops from inner tensions, you need to see the difference between the abolishing of the state and the withering of the state. Okay? If I want to abolish your life, I could take out a gun right now and put an end to it. From outside, I externally exterminate your life. I abolish you. But you know, if I allow you to live long enough, you'll wither away on your own, won't you? Old age, disease, lack of food, whatever. The point is, you'll finally wither away. I use this stark contrast so you understand. Marx was looking not for the abolishing of the state, external termination, but he said the state will finally not be needed. It's just going to wither away. A spirit of voluntary cooperation is coming, which will permit the state to dwindle and eventually be extinct. Please don't laugh out loud, just write it down. A spirit of voluntary cooperation is coming, which will permit the state to dwindle and eventually be extinct. All right? I hope you're getting a much more accurate and helpful understanding. Marx says there are these inner tensions in history. They're caused by economic conditions. The means of production have brought us to a day where we have collectivized those means of production, rapid increase in technology and output means that everyone can enjoy these material conditions. But surplus value is being skimmed off by the owners, and that gives them a certain ideology. The workers don't have the same ideology. That creates a clash of ideology, class warfare, and there's going to be a dictatorship of the proletariat in the revolution, which means in a democratic way, the workers are going to vote themselves into a better position economically and materially. But that still is a state, and that means there's coercion. One day, people will so voluntarily cooperate with each other that they won't need a state to coerce them at all. Engels wrote, and I quote, "A revolution is certainly the most authoritarian thing there is. A revolution is certainly the most authoritarian thing there is. He said it involves violent imposition of the will of some on the will of others, and it requires the maintaining of the changes by a rule of terror. So according to Engels, revolution just introduces the terror of the state all over again. Maybe it's a better state, but it's still a state. And so the revolution that Engels and Marx proposed was to be a peaceful process. Engels said, and I quote, "The abolition of capital is in itself the social revolution." Both he and Marx felt that it was foolish to be provoked into street fighting with the ruling army. I said, why do that? The democratic process will give you what you want. You don't need to get into a street fight with the army. Late in his life, Engels wrote, and I quote, "The bourgeois and the government came to be more afraid of the legal than of the illegal action of the Workers' Party, of the results of elections than of those of rebellion." Okay? Marx and Engels did not say, let's go get the guns and get into a street fight. They said, don't be stupid. What they really fear is that you'll use the democratic process to get what you want. Well, then how did something that was a proposal of peaceful revolution, the inner dynamic of history, how did it turn into violent revolution? Well, Marx expected a violent reaction from the ruling class and the opponents of the abolition of capital. Marx says, you're going to do this democratically, you're going to try to do this peacefully, but ideological interest, class warfare, will lead the capitalist to then resort, when they can't keep their way through the democratic process, they will resort to violent oppression against the workers. Please remember that, because we usually have it put on Marx that he was fomenting violent revolution against the capitalist. He didn't. He said, but I do fully expect the capitalist to violently react to you. And then he held to the right of an armed, violent resistance. He openly upheld the right of a armed, violent resistance to the violence of the capitalist when they don't like the way the democratic process is going. You need to add to this that neither Marx or Engels precluded a violent revolution eventually coming if the revolution could not be accomplished democratically. And now we're back to where you usually are in your prejudices against Marx. Marx said if the peaceful revolution doesn't bring it about, then eventually you've got to resort to violence. So where does violence come in, according to Marx? Not at the outset. He's not just calling for a coup against the government. But he says either the capitalist will violently try to repress the workers, in which case they have the right to defend themselves. By the way, you'd probably all agree with that, I would think, in general. Or, he said, after you've exhausted the peaceful means of equalizing the material benefits of this world, if they will not, if they entrench themselves, then and only then would violent revolution be called for. And at some places in his writings, I'm trying to remember now, Marx proposes that this could take, 50 years or so. So he wasn't saying, look, they're going to give it to us in 6 months or we're going to take it from them. He said, use democracy. In fact, he said most workers today are too uneducated to know how to use democracy. It's going to take a generation or so, two or so generations. But then, he said, then, if it can't be accomplished democratically, the revolution could turn violent. He also held that post-revolutionary terrorism would be not only legitimate, but recommended. If it does come to violence, if the capitalist war against you and you have to fight back, or after, this long period of democratic attempts, if you have to take up arms, he said, after the revolution, terror is not just something that is unavoidable, and you have to accept it, but also recommend it. He said, terror against hated individuals and hated places of recollection by a frightened people to reassure themselves would be called for. Here are people who have taken over, they're frightened, and so those people, like the Tsar and others, who represent their oppression previously, then you could exercise terror toward them. Right, to this point, I hope you understand the place of terror, violence, armed resistance in the revolution, given what Marx and Engels themselves had to say. In the first place, they did not want a violent revolution. They expected it to be democratic. In their view, the dictatorship of the proletariat was quite democratic. But in the end, violence could be legitimated and maybe even necessary. I want you to understand the difference between communism and socialism. But that's a very hard thing to do because these words are used in so many different ways. Just to illustrate how they're used differently, early in his career, Friedrich Engels declared socialism to be contrary to communism. But later in his writings, he presented communism as a school of socialism. That's frustrating to anybody who's trying to be analytically precise, right? So how do communism and socialism relate to each other? Well, the words are used in different ways. And indeed, if you look at the writings of Lenin, Lenin said socialism was the first step, communism a later step of development. So, I mean, which is it? One view says they're opposed to each other. One view says one's broader than the other. The other view says one is a step toward the other. So who knows, right? But we can, I think, by further analysis, get some distinctive understanding of communism in contrast to the earlier use of the word, the broader use of the word socialism. What communism does that socialism earlier did not do is concentrate on the means of production, class struggle, resentment of capital and surplus value, and the workers' revolution. Workers' revolution. Earlier socialism called for a total social revolution. Everybody wants to share everything. So communism, just to get your conceptual tools more precise, concentrates on the means of production, class struggle, resentment of capital or surplus value, and the workers' revolution. And this will surprise you once again, I think. Karl Marx opposed socialist notions, which are very common in our day, socialist notions of fair distribution of income. Marx opposed the redistributing of the total wealth of society. He opposed the fixing of prices according to labor cost. These are socialist ideas that Marx opposed. He didn't believe in fair distribution of income, redistributing of the total wealth of society, or the fixing of prices according to labor cost. Well, then what does it mean when he says, from each according to his abilities to each according to his needs? You need to write that down. That's one of the mottos of communism, right? From each according to his abilities to each according to his needs. Marx said that that slogan, he questioned the viability of it early on after the revolution. That is, in any early phase after the revolution, he said, you can't have from each according to his abilities to each according to his needs. He said that slogan can only become a reality, listen, only after people themselves change in their moral framework and their attitude toward work. Once people have been freed of the oppression of capitalism and they go through a period where they don't have to be so worried about their needs being met and the state doesn't have to be there to coerce them and is withering away, as people are now developing their own potential, you know, through culture, works of art, ideals, caring for one another, and not being worried whether they'll have bread and potatoes tomorrow to eat. Once people have a long period where they can be transformed, they can change in their moral framework and their attitude toward work, seeing work as desirable in itself. That is, you are not going to be compelled to go to work in a communist society. You're going to go to work because you want to go to work. Now, of course, that is a wonderful ideal. I count it as one of the, for all of the things that are hard in my life, I count it as a supreme privilege that, unlike most people that I know, I do exactly what I want to do to make a living. I get to read books and write articles and do debates and teach people, and I love my work. And if I had all the money in the world, I would be doing virtually the very same thing I'm doing this morning, even though I don't need a paycheck. So I have a real sympathy for this. Wouldn't that be great if we all worked because we loved the work and not because we were forced to by circumstances? Marx said, after a period following the revolution, people will change in their moral outlook. They'll work because they desire to work, not because they are compelled to. And then it will become true, from each according to his abilities, to each according to his needs. Right? There is a glimmer of Christian truth in that. Because if I had enough money to take care of my needs, and I'm able to do my research and writing and lecturing and debating and the things that I enjoy doing, and I saw that you needed a bit more, in order to get a new car for your family or something, I would freely give you what I have because I don't need it anyway. So, of course, from each according to his ability to each according to his need. Let me ask you, is there not something of that that's supposed to be reflected in the Christian church? Where without any concern for being repaid, I'll say, of course I'll loan you this money to get shoes on your children's feet. If you can't pay me back, don't worry about it. There isn't enough of that in the Christian church, but there should be. We all preach it as an ideal. Well, Marx had the same ideal. By the way, this is what I was trying to communicate to the Philosophers Association in Moscow. I said, Marx just had, if you will, the evil twin version of Christianity. He had an eschatology, he had a view of history, just like we have an eschatology, a view of history. He believed that people should work because they desire it and they should share with one another freely. Christians teach that as well. What you have here are two religions. Marx, however, said that his was not utopian, but was scientific socialism. Not utopian, but scientific. Because he had all this rational analysis of how it would develop and so forth. It wasn't just desiring something that looks real good and it's really beyond our reach. It's something that is necessary in developing in history. So scientific socialism versus utopian. That would be a great exam question. Explain why Marx communism was scientific socialism in his view rather than utopian socialism. Distinguish all of the misperceptions of Marx and so forth. So do you have a pretty good idea of where Marx is going? What's my criticism of him? Well, before I criticize him, the lasting intellectual impact of Marx, I think, is the place of social economics in history. It's really difficult after Marx for anybody to give an adequate historical account of anything without looking at the social economics. He did stamp that upon Western culture. Secondly, the greatest polemical concept introduced by Marx, I think he was dead wrong in what he was talking about, but this concept has taken hold and is used polemically, and that's that of exploitation. The rationalizing of one's privilege and the exploiting of others. So the place of social economics in history and the dynamic of exploitation. These are the lasting cultural contributions of Karl Marx. But now, how would I criticize what Marxism is now that we've tried to give a more fair presentation of it? Well, the first thing I'd say is that it's outright utopian. That's not scientific at all. It's pie in the sky, by and by. You see that real obviously when he talks about how human nature is going to be changed. We're all going to work because we love it and share because we care for one another. Well, I'll get to that in particular, but my general criticism is this is utopian, not scientific socialism. And I have a series of criticisms here, which I'll have to speak quickly so we can get them in before the tape runs out. First of all, and again, I'm following Thomas Sowell in much of this, not altogether, but a good deal of it. As Sowell points out, speaking boldly in the name of the workers without their consent and contrary to the expressed wishes and views of the workers has made Marxism an instrument of elite domination. Ironically, Marxism has not created workers dictating social conditions, but those who speak in the name of the workers, the elite, dominating others. Secondly, the writing of Marx is so convoluted, so full of jargon, so weighed down with witty epigrams that lead you to overstatement and misinterpretation. It's so subject to this, to so many interpretations, that even in his lifetime, Marx said, quote, "I am not a Marxist." Imagine the frustration, you know. Marxist people are interpreting my words in a way where I'm not a Marxist. So you have Leninism, Trotskyism, Maoism, the German Social Democrats. They all claim to be following Marx, and yet they disagree with one another. Thirdly, Marx's simplistic and arbitrary notion of output per unit of labor, that is the notion that you have this idea of output divided by unit of labor, is crucial to the cogency of his notion of surplus value or exploitation. That is, if it's scientific, exploitation needs to be put down to a rational formula, which was output of a factory per unit of labor. But the notion of output per unit of labor is utterly arbitrary. It's overly simple. It's not scientific at all. The very fact that you can make a mathematical formula doesn't mean there's any connection between output and unit of labor. The input that goes toward the output of a factory or a business includes far more than what is contributed by labor. It includes the entrepreneurship, the taking of risk, the investment, the managerial skills, the interpersonal skills, the selling skills, on and on and on. Labor is not the determining factor. I mean, that is such a simplistic mistake in economic analysis, and that is what drives the whole notion of exploitation for him. Here's an empirical refutation. Countries with less labor input, like the United States, relative to other countries, have a vastly higher standard of living. How can that be? The whole concept of exploitation would make that impossible. But it's not. Where there is less labor, there's nevertheless a higher standard of living for everybody. And so where Karl Marx said we will equalize the standard of living by not exploiting labor, it turns out that when you don't have a lot of labor, you can still have a generalized and higher standard of living. And so he's just empirically wrong about how economics works. He doesn't take account of the unseen capital of managerial skills, entrepreneurial innovation, and particularly personal discipline that makes the difference, not labor. And so Marx was not giving scientific analysis at all. A further problem, socialist managers and central planners will prove not to be as zealous to seek efficiency in a business as the greedy investors and owners. Well, I have a beautiful example of that. When I was in Moscow, we went to a restaurant one day. There was no one in the restaurant. The waitress would not seat us. My Russian guide called for the manager, got into an argument with the manager. We finally got a seat at the table. So by this time, I'm going, wow, what's going on? I asked him to explain that. And Lukoff says, Greg, don't you see what has happened? Over 50 years of communism have created the mentality that we get paid the same thing if we work as if we don't work. So it's better for her to shoo us away and not serve us, and she'll get paid the same thing at the end of the day, and the manager will get the same pay whether we're here or not. Think about it. Socialism, socialism doesn't put pressure on people to seek efficiency and service to others. Only the greed of the owner leads him to say, of course I want you to be happy. What can I get you? Let me give it to you at a lower price than my competitor. And thus, inward motives aside, Marxism does not, in empirical, practical terms, drive down production cost. And thus, Marxism doesn't leave more to pay your laborers, nor does it lower prices, and so it doesn't benefit the consuming public at large. Capitalism drives production costs down so there's more money to pay the laborers and makes the price of products lower so that society in general can have it. When VCRs first came out, very few people could afford them. Now everybody's got them in their home. Why? Because of capitalism. It's that competition, quote-unquote, the greed that improved the lot of the workers and the general social condition as well. Marx just doesn't understand economics. Without the profit incentive, socialist planners do not, in fact, take on the risk of pioneering innovation. That's why when you go to Moscow, you will find that they can't fix the machinery and the electronic things that they have over there. People will not invest in the risk of upgrading, engaging in innovation. They'll play it safe for the sake of protecting their position. Okay? In a capitalist company, if you're a manager, you don't play it safe. You try to do better, so you'll take some risk. You'll move ahead. Not in a socialist economy. You say, look, I've risen to this position of being manager. I'm not going to take any chances. No, I'm not going to try anything new. I'm not going to innovate. I'm not going to be an entrepreneur. That's just a fact of life. A planned economy does not prevent the disproportionality of output that Marx was so upset about and was supposed to be the alleged fault of the capitalists for the crises that we go through. A planned economy doesn't prevent disproportionality of output. It merely conceals the disproportionality of output. Here's a good example. You want full employment? We can give you full employment. You can have people dig ditches all day and then fill them in the afternoon. Everybody's employed. But what's the problem with that? It doesn't generate any revenue, does it? But after all, you have full employment. So, yeah, socialism can mask disproportionality of output, but it can't solve the problem. Such disproportionality is inescapable. And so we have to ask, as Thomas Sowell does, pushing even harder, where has there ever been empirical evidence of the alleged increasing misery of the proletariat under capitalism? We're still waiting for anybody to do a comparative empirical analysis that capitalist countries have increasing misery for their working class. Remember, it's comparative, compared to a socialist economy. Where is there any evidence of that? Capitalist countries do not see the increasing misery, comparatively, of the working class.
This recording has been released into the public domain by the Bahnsen Institute. Duplication, sharing, and distribution is encouraged. For more information about the life and ministry of Dr. Greg L. Bahnsen, visit our website, bahnseninstitute.com, where we aim to bring into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ.